entirely under my wife's management as a rule, and except for Miss Brett, who, as I say, is very active, I scarcely know any members of it. I had, however, promised to drop in on them, and I did so. When I arrived, there were only four other maiden ladies with Miss Brett, but they were sewing very busily. It is very difficult, of course, for any person, however strongly impressed with the necessity in these matters of full and exact exposition of the facts, to remember and repeat the actual details of a conversation, particularly a conversation which, though inspired with the most worthy and admirable zeal for good work, was one which did not greatly impress the hearer's mind at the time, and was, in fact, mostly about socks. I can, however, remember distinctly that one of the spinster ladies, she was a thin person with a woolen shawl who appeared to feel the cold, and I am almost sure she was introduced to me as Miss James, remarked that the weather was very changeable. Miss Brett then offered me a cup of tea, which I accepted. I cannot recall in what words. Miss Brett is a short, stout lady with white hair. The only other figure in the group that caught my attention was a Miss Mowbray, a small and neat lady of aristocratic manners, silver hair and a high voice and color. She was the most emphatic member of the party, and her views on the subject of pinafores, though expressed with a natural deference to myself, were in themselves strong and advanced. Beside her, although all five ladies were dressed simply in black, it could not be denied that the others looked, in some ways, what you men of the world would call dowdy. After about 10 minutes' conversation, I rose to go, and as I did so, I heard something which, I cannot describe it, something which seemed to, but I really cannot describe it. "What did you hear?" I asked, with some impatience. "I heard," said the vicar solemnly, "I heard Miss Mowbray, the lady with the silver hair, say to Miss James, the lady with the woolen shawl, the following extraordinary words. I committed them to memory on the spot, and as soon as circumstances set me free to do so, I noted them down on a piece of paper. I believe I have it here." He fumbled in his breast pocket, bringing out mild things, notebooks, circulars, and programs of village concerts. "I heard Miss Mowbray say to Miss James the following words, 'Now's your time, Bill.'" He gazed at me for a few moments after making this announcement, gravely and unflinchingly, as if conscious that here he was unshaken about his facts. Then he resumed, turning his bald head more towards the fire. This appeared to me remarkable. I could not by any means understand it. It seemed to me first of all peculiar that one maiden lady should address another maiden lady as Bill. My experience, as I have said, may be incomplete. Maiden ladies may have among themselves and in exclusively spinster circles wilder customs than I am aware of. But it seemed to me odd, and I could almost have sworn, if you will not misunderstand the phrase, I should have been strongly impelled to maintain at the time that the words, "Now's your time, Bill," were by no means pronounced with that upper-class intonation which, as I have already said, had up to now characterized Miss Mowbray's conversation. In fact, the words, "Now's your time, Bill," would have been, I fancy, unsuitable if pronounced with that upper-class intonation. I was surprised, I repeat, then, at the remark, but I was still more surprised when, looking round me in bewilderment, my hat and umbrella in hand, I saw the lean lady with the woolen shawl leaning upright against the door out of which I was just about to make my exit. She was still knitting, and I suppose that this erect posture against the door was only an eccentricity of spinsterhood and an oblivion of my intended departure. I said genially, "I am so sorry to disturb you, Miss James, but I really must be going. I stopped here for the words she had uttered in reply, though singularly brief and in tone extremely businesslike, were such as to render that arrest of my remarks, I think, natural and excusable. I have these words also noted down. I have not the least idea of their meaning, so I have only been able to render them phonetically." But she said, and Mr. Shorter peered short-sightedly at his papers, she said, "Chuck it, Fat Ed. And she added something that sounded like, it's a cock, or possibly a cot. That's spelled with a K. And then the last cord, either of my sanity or the sanity of the universe, snapped suddenly. My esteemed friend and helper, Miss Brett, standing by the mantelpiece, said, put his old Ed in a bag, Sam, and tie him up before you start jawing. You'll be copped yourself some of these days with this way of coning things. Harlar Theater. My head went round and round. Was it really true, as I had suddenly fancied a moment before, that unmarried ladies had some dreadful, riotous society of their own from which all others were excluded? I remembered dimly in my classical days. I was a scholar in a small way once, but now, alas, rusty. I remembered the mysteries of the Bona Di and their strange female Freemasonry. I remembered the witches' Sabbaths. I was just, in my absurd lightheadedness, trying to remember a line of verse about Diana's nymphs when Miss Mowbray threw her arm round me from behind. The moment it held me, I knew it was not a woman's arm. Miss Brett, or what I had called Miss Brett, was standing in front of me with a big revolver in her hand and a broad grin on her face. Miss James was still leaning against the door, but had fallen into an attitude so totally new and so totally unfeminine that it gave one a shock. She was kicking her heels with her hands in her pockets and her cap on one side. She was a man.
It was a man.
Mr. Shorter became indescribably flurried and flapping in endeavoring to arrange these genders in his plaid shawl at the same time. He resumed with a higher fever of nervousness. As for Miss Mowbray, he held me in a ring of iron. She had his arm around her neck, my neck, I mean, and I could not cry out. Mr. Brett, at least something who was not Miss Brett, had the revolver pointed at me. The other two ladies, or gentlemen, were rummaging in some bag in the background. It was all clear at last. They were criminals dressed up as women to kidnap me, to kidnap the Vicar of Chuntsey in Essex. But why? Was it to be nonconformists? The brute leaning against the door called out carelessly, "Hurry up, 'Arry. Show the old bloke what the game is, and let's get off." "Curse his eyes," said Miss Brett. I mean the man with the revolver. "Why should we show him the game?" "If you take my advice, you bloomin' well will," said the man at the door, whom they called Bill. "A man what knows what he's doin' is worth 10 what don't, even if he's a potty old parson." "Bill's right enough," said the coarse voice of the man who held me. It had been Miss Mowbray's. "Bring out the picture, 'Arry." The man with the revolver walked across the room to where the other two women, I mean men, were turning over baggage and asked them for something which they gave him. He came back with it across the room and held it out in front of me. And compared to the surprise of that display, all the previous surprises of this awful day shrank suddenly. It was a portrait of myself. That such a picture should be in the hands of these scoundrels might in any case have caused a mild surprise, but no more. It was no mild surprise that I felt. The likeness was an extremely good one, worked up with all the accessories of the conventional photographic studio. I was leaning my head on my hand and was relieved against a painted landscape of woodland. It was obvious that it was no snapshot. It was clear that I had sat for this photograph, and the truth was that I never sat for such a photograph. It was a photograph that I had never had taken. I stared at it again and again. It seemed to me to be touched up a good deal. It was glazed as well as framed, and the glass blurred some of the details. But there unmistakably was my face, my eyes, my nose, my mouth, my head and hand, posed for a professional photographer. And I had never posed so for any photographer. Behold the bloomin' miracle, said the man with the revolver with ill-timed facetiousness. Carson, prepare to meet your God. And with this he slid the glass out of the frame. As the glass moved, I saw that part of the picture was painted on it in Chinese white, notably a pair of white whiskers and a clerical collar. And underneath was a portrait of an old lady in a quiet black dress, leaning her head on her hand against the woodland landscape. The old lady was as like me as one pin is like another. It had required only the whiskers and the collar to make it me in every hair. Entertainin', ain't it? Said the man, described as airy, as he shot the glass back again. Remarkable resemblance, Parson. Gratifying to the lady, gratifying to you. And I might had, particularly gratifying to us, as being the probable source of a very tolerable haul. You know Colonel Hawker, the man who come to live in these parts, don't you? I nodded. Well, said the man, airy, pointing to the picture, that's his mother, who ran to catch him when he fell, she did, and he flung his fingers in a general gesture toward the photograph of the old lady, who was exactly like me. Tell the old gent what he's got to do and be done with it, broke old Bill from the door. Look here, Reverend, shorter, we ain't going to do you no harm. We're giving you a sov for your trouble if you like. And as for the old woman's clothes, why, you'll look lovely in 'em. You ain't much of a bad hand at a description, Bill, said the man behind me. Mr. Shorter, it's like this. We've got to see this man Hawker tonight. Maybe he'll kiss us all and have up the champagne when he sees us. Maybe on the other hand he won't. Maybe he'll be dead when we goes away. Maybe not. But we got to see him. Now, as you know, he shuts himself up and never opens the door to a soul. Only you don't know why, and we does. The only one as ever can get at him is his mother. Well, it's a confounded funny coincidence, he said, accenting the penultimate. It's a very unusual piece of good luck, but you're his mother. When first I saw her picture, said the man Bill, shaking his head in a ruminant manner, when I first saw it, I said, old Shorter. Those were my exact words, old Shorter. What do you mean, you wild creatures, I gasped. What am I to do? That's easy, said your oldness, said the man with the revolver, good-humoredly. You got to put on those clothes. He pointed to a poke bonnet and a heap of female clothes in the corner of the room. I will not dwell, Mr. Swinburne, upon the details of what followed. I had no choice. I could not fight five men, to say nothing of a loaded pistol. In 5 minutes, sir, the vicar of Chuntsey was dressed as an old woman, as somebody else's mother, if you please, and was dragged out of the house to take part in a crime. It was already late in the afternoon, and the nights of winter were closing in fast. On a dark road in a blowing wind, we set out towards the lonely house of Colonel Hawker, perhaps the queerest cortege that ever struggled up that or any other road. To every human eye and every external, we were six very respectable old ladies of small means, in black dresses and refined but antiquated bonnets, and we were really five criminals and a clergyman. I will cut a long story short. My brain was whirling like a windmill as I walked, trying to think of some manner of escape. To cry out, so long as we were far from houses, would be suicidal, for it would be easy for the ruffians to knife me or gag me and fling me into a ditch. On the other hand, to attempt to stop strangers and explain the situation was impossible, because of the frantic folly of the situation itself. Long before I had persuaded the chance postman or carrier of so absurd a story, my companions would certainly have got off themselves, and in all possibility would have carried me off, as a friend of theirs who had the misfortune to be mad or drunk. The last thought, however, was an inspiration, though a very terrible one. Had it come to this, that the vicar of Chuntsey must pretend to be mad or drunk? It had come to this. I walked along with the rest up the deserted road, imitating and keeping pace as far as I could, with their rapid and yet ladylike step, until at length I saw a lamppost and a policeman standing under it. I had made up my mind. Until we reached them, we were all equally demure and silent and swift. When we reached them, I suddenly flung myself against the railings and roared out, "Hooray! Hooray!
Hooray! Rule Britannia! Get your hair cut! Hoopla! Boo!
It was a condition of no little novelty for a man in my position. The constable instantly flashed his lantern on me, or the draggled, drunken old woman that was my travesty. "Now then, Mum," he began gruffly. "Come along quiet, or I'll eat your heart," cried Sam in my ear hoarsely. "Stop, or I'll flay you." It was frightful to hear the words and see the neatly sprawled old spinster who whispered them. I yelled and yelled. I was in for it now. I screamed comic relief refrains that vulgar young men had sung to my regret at our village concerts. I rolled to and fro like a ninepin about to fall. "If you can't get your friend on quiet, ladies," said the policeman, "I shall have to take her up. Drunk and disorderly she is, right enough." I redoubled my efforts. I had not been brought up to this sort of thing, but I believe I eclipsed myself. Words that I did not know I had ever heard of seemed to come pouring out of my open mouth. "When we get you past," whispered Bill, "you'll howl louder. You'll howl louder when you're burning your feet off." I screamed in my terror those awful songs of joy. In all the nightmares that men have ever dreamed, there has never been anything so blighting and horrible as the faces of those five men, looking out of their poke bonnets, the figures of district visitors with the faces of devils. I cannot think there is anything so heartbreaking in hell. For a sickening instant, I thought that the bustle of my companions and the perfect respectability of all our dresses would overcome the policeman and induce him to let us pass. He wavered, so far as one can describe anything so solid as a policeman as wavering. I lurched suddenly forward and ran my head into his chest, calling out, if I remember correctly, "Oh, cricky, blimey, Bill." It was at that moment that I remembered most dearly that I was the vicar of Chuntsey in Essex. My desperate coup saved me. The policeman had me hard by the back of the neck. "You come along with me," he began, but Bill cut in with his perfect imitation of a lady's finicking voice. "Oh, pray, constable, don't make a disturbance with our poor friend. We will get her quietly home. She does drink too much, but she is quite a lady, only eccentric." "She butted me in the stomach," said the policeman briefly. "Eccentricities of genius," said Sam earnestly. "Pray, let me take her home," reiterated Bill in the resumed character of Miss James. "She wants looking after." "She does," said the policeman, "but I'll look after her." "That's no good," said Bill feverishly. "She wants her friends. She wants a particular medicine we've got." "Yes," assented Miss Mowbray with excitement. "No other medicine any good, constable. Complaint quite unique." "I'm all right. Coochie coochie coo," remarked to his internal shame the vicar of Chuntsey. "Look here, ladies," said the constable sternly. "I don't like the eccentricity of your friend, and I don't like her songs or her head in my stomach. And now I come to think of it, I don't like the looks of you. I've seen many as quiet dressed as you as was wrong uns. Who are you?" "We've not our cards with us," said Miss Mowbray with indescribable dignity, "nor do we see why we should be insulted by any jack in office who chooses to be rude to ladies when he is paid to protect them. If you choose to take advantage of the weakness of our unfortunate friend, no doubt you are legally entitled to take her. But if you fancy you have any legal right to bully us, you will find yourself in the wrong box." The truth and dignity of this staggered the policemen for a moment. Under cover of their advantage, my five persecutors turned for an instant on me, faces like faces of the damned, and then swished off into the darkness. When the constable first turned his lantern and his suspicions onto them, I had seen the telegraphic look flash from face to face, saying that only retreat was possible now. By this time I was sinking slowly to the pavement in a state of acute reflection. So long as the ruffians were with me, I dared not quit the role of drunkard. For if I had begun to talk reasonably and explain the real case, the officer would merely have thought that I was slightly recovered and would have put me in charge of my friends. Now, however, if I liked, I might safely undeceive him. But I confess I did not like.
The chances of life are many, and it may doubtless sometimes lie in the narrow path of duty for a clergyman of the Church of England to pretend to be a drunken old woman. But such necessities are, I imagine, sufficiently rare to appear to